We come to Buddhist ethics and Buddhist morality. We have so far we had a look at right view on the gradual training, how right view leads quite naturally to right aim, right intention, samma sankappa, samma ditti, and samma sankappa. And now we move on to the other parts of the Noble Eightfold Path. We have right action here and then right speech, and these are all about morality here. It is interesting that if you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, it has often right speech first, and here we have right action before right speech. And I don't know, I just think that is quite random which one you take first. It doesn't really matter so much, and that is perhaps why you have this kind of interchange. One comes before in the Eightfold Path, the other one comes first in the gradual training. I'm not sure if it really matters all that much. But Buddhist morality is very interesting, and it is one of the beautiful aspects of the Buddhist path. It's one of the most basic ones, of course, but also very beautifully how it is explained by the Buddha. Buddhist morality is very different from the vast majority of ethical system that you find, especially in religions. And the reason why it is different is because it is not really rule-based. Usually religions have rule-based ethics. These are the things you should do. God said you should do this or you should not do that or whatever. And then it kind of certain rules. But in Buddhism, ethics is really based on a more rational approach to what is appropriate and what is not appropriate to do. And this is very, for that reason, it's very interesting and it's very applicable. It's something that is just as applicable to a secular society as it is to a religion or whatever else. And of course, in Buddhism, we're talking about kamma. Kamma means action. Yeah, it is kamma that is either it is good kamma or it is bad kamma. That is where the idea of good and bad kamma comes from. It basically means it is a good and bad act. But kamma in itself is not sufficient. Kamma is just the outward act, but of course from a Buddhist point of view, what really matters is the mental state that comes with that kamma. And that's why in Buddhism we say that the kamma really is intention. It is the intention of the mind that actually matters as far as action is concerned. The famous statement in the suttas where the Buddha says, Chetana aham bhikkave kammang vadami. It is intention, monks, that I call kamma. And it's one of those, I think, very significant statements in the suttas where the Buddha makes a very clear distinction between his teaching and other teachings that existed at the time. So intention is about what we are trying to achieve. It's about our purpose, our aim. So if there's no intention there, there cannot be bad kamma. It makes very good sense. Right, if you step on an ant by accident, and unfortunately that happens all the time, but there's no bad intention there, so it's not an issue. But if you purposely kill an insect, of course it's a different situation, because then you are directing your mind in that direction, and then there is a problem. So intention is the first step to understand the idea of Buddhist ethics. And the next step is to understand that what is it that colors that intention? Intention itself is neutral. Intention just means that you have a purpose, right? But what is it that makes that intention either good or bad or neutral? And that is where we have the idea of motivation on the Buddhist path. It's called mula in Pali. Mula means like the root of the action. And motivation is the force that drives your intention, is the force behind the intention that gives the intention color, either a good, bright color or a dark color, depending on the kind, or maybe neutral color, depending on the type of intention you have. And in Buddhism, we talk about six kinds of roots, usually, six kinds of motivations, just to classify in a fairly simple way. And those motivations are the motivation of greed. Yeah, looking after, kind of just looking after yourself, not caring so much about others, ill will, and delusion. So these are the three unwholesome roots. And then on the other hand, we have the three wholesome roots, which are then non-greed, or if you like, you can call it generosity if you want, because they're very similar, related to each other. Non-ill will, which is very closely related to the idea of metta, kindness to others, goodwill, And then the opposite of delusion, non-delusion, clarity of mind, not being confused, right? These kind of things. So these are the root things that make actions either positive or negative. And this is very interesting because when we use rules to express morality, and of course the usual rules that we have in Buddhism, 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 227 precepts, 311 precepts, right? So the nuns have the most precepts. So if the more precepts you have, the better it is, and the kind of nuns are the top of the hierarchy. That's what it sounds like, right? When you look at that. It doesn't quite work like that. It's a bit random how these precepts come about, so it doesn't really. But anyway, and then you have the 10 ways of wholesome and unwholesome action, right? All of these are kind of laying down, is a rule-based morality here. And it's important to remember that the rules in Buddhism are only approximations to the reality of morality. Morality always comes back to this idea of what is driving the act, what is the motivation. This particular thing I was just talking about a second ago, about the 6 roots of actions, that is actually found in a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, and there it explicitly says that any action driven by the good motivations is always positive. Any action driven by the unwholesome roots is always negative. So if you compare that to the precepts, like the 5 precepts, there it is very square. If you kill, it is bad. But actually, it depends on how you kill. That really matters. There are many different ways of killing. You can kill out of hate, which is very, very bad. You can kill out of greed, right, which of course also is bad. But you can also kill out of less bad motivations. You can kill perhaps even out of compassion, out of kindness, out of care, if you are very careful about how you do things. So it changes your perspective on morality when you come down to a motivational type of morality here. And that is what really matters. And it makes the Buddhist idea of ethics and morality incredibly flexible. We can deal with almost all dilemmas of ethics and morality in a very rational and a very reasonable way. We're not trapped into some kind of ancient system, ancient rules that were applicable to society 3,000 years ago or 2,500 years ago. We're not trapped by those things, and we have the ability to be flexible and adapt to modern situations. So it's a very modern and a very rational way of looking at ethics. And this makes the Buddhist ethics so, in my opinion, so wonderful and so usable and so practical and pragmatic and something that we almost like we have to teach the world the Buddhist ethics because they make such good sense. Even when ordinary secular society has problems in dealing with things and coming to conclusions about ethics, often we already have the answers as Buddhists. But of course, it's also quite a difficult way of ethics. And it's difficult because it means that you have to know personally whether your action is ethical or not. Only you can know that. Only you can know your intention. Only you can know the motivation inside of yourself. So it's a very personal kind of ethics. And sometimes we're not sure. Our motivations seem mixed, right? And that complicates things. And that is where the idea of precepts and things come in. Because sometimes we are confused, sometimes we don't know. Then at the very least, we can hold on to the 5 precepts or the 8 precepts or whatever. Hold on to that as an approximation to the truth. We're going to be very, very close. If you keep the 5 precepts, you're going to be very close to living a very pure and a good life. But it is not the final arbiter of what is good morality, if you like, on the Buddhist path. Another aspect of Buddhist morality that is important, of course, once you understand that motivation is what really matters, is that motivation is very often mixed. It is neither completely pure nor completely dark. And this is another thing that you see in the suttas. The Buddha talks about different kinds of action. He talks about actions that are bright with bright results. He talks about actions that are dark with dark results. And he talks about actions that are dark and bright with dark and bright results. And very often, our actions are not either completely pure, right? It's not completely bright. When the Buddha talks about bright actions, he talks about actions where there's no hindrances in the mind whatsoever that lead to rebirth in the Brahma world. This is kind of the pure actions. How often do we do those actions? It's only after you come out of a very profound state of samadhi and you're completely blissed out and you want to go out into the world and hug everyone and you're so happy and you feel this kind of enormous metta towards the whole world. And we don't usually feel that way. Most people don't feel like that way all the time. And also very rarely that we have the exact opposite, where our mind is completely dark, you hate absolutely everyone in the whole world, and you're kind of really negative, and all you want to do is to do bad stuff and be really, really nasty. That is also very rare, right? So most of the time, we're somewhere in between. Our mind is not entirely bright and pure, nor is it entirely dark and negative. It is somewhere in between there. So our motivations tend to be mixed, and this is a very important part of this. So what that means is that what we are trying when we live the ethical life is to brighten up our actions a little bit. People often ask you as a monastic, is this good or is it bad? This act, was it good or was it bad? And very often the answer is, well, actually it was somewhere in between probably. It was neither good nor bad. And only you can really tell, because the act itself is not good or bad. It's actually your intention that really matters there. Yeah, so our job is not so much to do just purely good karma and avoid purely bad karma. It is to kind of make our karma a little bit brighter, less dark, right? It's almost like the karma comes in shades of grey, and you want to make it a slightly lighter shade of grey, the way we act. And that is where things kind of come in. So when you do an act, when you do something, you say something to somebody else, you want to add a little bit more kindness into what you say here, a little bit more metta into what you say here, a little bit more compassion, understanding into what you say. And when you add more of those things into how you speak, it means that you are brightening things up, you are going towards lighter shades of grey, until one day, perhaps, you can do acts that are completely bright and completely beautiful, where there is no, just pure metta and kindness coming out of you. So this is a nice way of thinking about morality. How to make it avoid the darker shades of grey and move towards the lighter shades of grey. And then gradually, we're changing our outlook and moving in the appropriate direction. So those are some of the basic ideas of Buddhist karma. And of course, very often we simplify these things. We talk about karma being either good or bad. We talk about the five precepts. And it's very useful to simplify. Otherwise, it gets too complicated for daily life. But please remember these broader ideas, because this is actually, to me, what makes Buddhist ethics so beautiful, so usable, so pragmatic, and such. Basically, it's based on universal principles of how the mind works and how we deal with people. And that, of course, is very useful. So now let us have a look at how this actually works in practice. So we're going to have a look at right action, first of all, samma kammanta. And we have just seen how the monk or nun goes forth, and then this is what happens after they have gone forth. Having thus gone forth and possessing the bhikkhus or bhikkhunis training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, they abstain from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside. Conscientious, merciful, they abide compassionate to all living beings. So that, again, you can see there the similarity with the first precept, right, about avoiding killing anyone, and very similar to that. Here we have the person who has gone forth possessing the bhikkhu's training, sikka, quite literally means training, and training, the main meaning of that is what we're looking at now, the gradual training itself. It doesn't just refer to keeping precepts and that kind of stuff, but it refers to the whole way of life, sajiva, sikka, sajiva, that's the Pali words there. And that begins with this idea of not killing living beings. And right here you can see that there's two sides to this, right? You don't kill living beings, but not just don't you kill living beings, you are actually, as it says, you are conscientious, merciful, compassionate. So not only do you avoid something, you actually do something active in the opposite direction. And this is the other beautiful thing about Buddhist morality. Buddhist morality is not just about avoiding the bad stuff, it is about doing the good things. Yeah, and that is when your progress on the path really starts to take off, because by avoiding the bad stuff, you avoid feeling regret and remorse and feeling, oh, why did I do that? And by doing the good things, you actually feel positively happy about your life. You feel positively happy about how you live. Yeah, so these two things, when they come together, they become a very powerful source for propelling you forward on the Buddhist path and making that path go even faster as a consequence. this is a very important thing. It's interesting here how it just focuses on the idea of killing living beings, but you can see from the idea, of course, of being compassionate, that it actually incorporates much more than that. It incorporates all kinds of avoiding of oppression and violence and all of this kind of stuff is obviously included in that. It's the exact opposite that we try to do as Buddhists. And again, the focus here is on the bhikkhus, on the monastics. The bhikkhunis are also included in this. But of course, it is exactly the same for lay people. It is just the focus here that is in this way. And I think you all know roughly what this is all referring to, and what we are dealing with here. Now, what we probably should talk about very briefly, because I think this kind of gives you some ideas about how Buddhist ethics is different from other kinds of ethics, that is to have a look at some of the typical dilemmas, ethical dilemmas that we talk about in the present day. And of course, the obvious one, which we always talk about in Buddhist circles, is euthanasia. Euthanasia is the obvious one, or assisted suicide, or whatever you want to call it. And this is one of those modern ethical dilemmas. And there is a lot of kind of the ability to end your life when you want to end it around the world these days. A lot of places where this is becoming legal, etc. And the question is, where does Buddhism stand on this? And again, Buddhism doesn't really have any absolute stand on that. The Buddhist idea is much more nuanced. The Buddhist idea is, well, where are you coming from when you want to do this? Why do you want to do this? If somebody is coming to the end of their life and they've had enough and they say, oh, actually, maybe let's turn the machines off. Is that ethical or not? Well, it depends on where you're coming from. If you're coming from a place of real compassion, not being deluded about what you're doing, but being clear and compassionate, then it cannot be bad karma from a Buddhist point of view. But you have to be careful, right? You really have to know your mind properly. Otherwise, you might just think you are compassionate. Actually, there is some other underlying motive, perhaps, that is driving you as well. So you need to have a degree of clarity there. If you are confused, never make these kind of decisions if you feel confused about it, because then you might go wrong. But if you feel confident, then that is the time to make these kind of decisions. And that is where Buddhism is different. So in that case, if you really are compassionate, it is very difficult to see how that could be. It cannot really be bad karma in that kind of situation. It might even be good karma if you want to help somebody in that kind of case. And similar way of looking at things go across the board with all of these kind of ethical dilemmas. You can use similar kind of strategies to understand whether something is wholesome or unwholesome. Any kind of ethical dilemma that has to do with ending life or and that sort of thing here. So that is the basic idea about killing and about how to deal with life in general, and how to move towards a more compassionate side of things. Let us move on to the next one. The next one here is the abandoning of taking of what is not given. He abstains from taking what is not given, taking only what is given her, expecting only what is given her. By not stealing, he abides in purity here. So this is similar to the second precept. And here we have expecting only what is given, which I think is better translated as wanting only what is given. Expecting is, I'm not sure exactly how that seems a little bit strange there, but wanting only what is given makes good sense. And the idea there, of course, is that it's not just an external purity, but actually it's an internal one where you mentally don't even want anything that hasn't been given to you. Or here, because we're talking about monastics, it is given, but of course in lay life, anything which is rightfully yours, if you like, that's all you're really expecting here, not anything else. So you can see here how the morality by body and the morality by mind are often very closely related to each other here. And by doing that, you are abiding in purity here. So the idea that stealing is an act of impurity, that you feel kind of impure by doing this. Of course, the opposite of stealing, which is not actually mentioned in this case, but which is very important on the Buddhist path, is generosity here. Right? Stealing, by its very nature, is a selfish act where you appropriate somebody else's things for yourself. And generosity is the exact opposite, where you give up what is yours for other people. It's the other side. And in this case, it is not mentioned here. And the reason why I think it is not mentioned is because it is such an important part of the Buddhist path in its own right, that is often talked about as a completely separate issue, the idea of being generous. And it's something that everyone should really develop in their lives. It is a little bit of I'm not sure why it isn't mentioned here, maybe because it is for the monastic path, maybe that is the reason, but the reality is that monastics too should be generous. You should be, you know, willing, not maybe generous so much in the material sense, but generous in other ways is certainly part of the monastic path as well. But generosity is very important and very fundamental. And if you want to have real success in your meditation practice, if you want to have real success with insight on this path, it can only happen if you have a truly generous heart. That heart which is generous, where you want to share with the whole world, you want to give, you want to just kind of, you feel this openness towards everyone around you. That is precisely the kind of mind state by using which it is possible to enter deep meditation and also to have good insights as a consequence. You really have to have that kind of mind state. And that is specifically said in the suttas. The Buddha says this specifically. It is this open-heartedness. We just want to give and share with everyone, right? That is the kind of thing that enables you to... because it's a very beautiful state. And I'm sure many of you know what I'm talking about, at least to some extent. When you feel generous, it's beautiful. It feels pure. It feels positive. There's something very nice about that. And it is quite easy to develop generosity. A lot of generosity, it just is in our intention to use the ordinary situations in our ordinary everyday in a good way. And when you use those things in a good way, then it becomes an act of generosity. I was mentioning yesterday about using work, for example, and family life for these kind of things. If you just have the right intention, you can actually make work an act of generosity rather than just being a way of making a living here. If you just make a living, if you're just waiting for your salary at the end of the week or whatever, then it's kind of pointless, right? And like the person was saying yesterday on the question, it feels kind of meaningless. But if instead of just, it's great to have we have to have a salary, of course, that's part of it. But if you make it also into something more than that, it becomes also part of your spiritual practice. Then you're kind of making something more out of life. Everything becomes meaningful in a very different way. Your family life, little things. And one of the quotes from the suttas that I often like to mention, which you probably heard me say many times before, but this is where the Buddha makes it clear how easy it can be to be generous. And he says that every time you wash your dishes and there will be a few rice grains or whatever left over in the dishwashing water, then the difference between generosity and not being generous is that when you throw out that dishwashing water, assuming that you don't just flush it down the sink, but you throw it out somewhere, like we do when we wash our bowls as monastics. You throw it out and you think, may all those little insects, all those little beings out there, may they feed on these little scraps of food. Yeah, that's enough. Already you're being generous. Already you're making good karma. Just by switching your intention from just chucking it out thoughtlessly to throwing it out with the thought, may the beings out there be happy. It's a wonderful thing. Another place where the Buddha talks about generosity, he says to his monks and nuns that if you knew the power of merit, the power of generosity in the way I know this power of generosity, you would never have a single meal without sharing some of your food with someone else. Yeah, you would never eat. You would always take the opportunity when the opportunity arises to share with somebody else. What a wonderful thing that is. So whenever you have something special, in our monastery we pretty much get the same food, but whenever you have something special that you can share with somebody, it's a beautiful opportunity to share that with somebody else. And you're building up this feeling of generosity inside, broadening out your mind, incorporating kind of this positive feeling for other people. It's almost like you are you're making your mind shift its perspective on other people, simply by the act of generosity to the people around you. So it's very important, and in many ways you can almost make your life into an act of generosity, whereby everything you do is generosity in one way or another. And in one sense, this is one of the great blessings of monastic life, is precisely that if you think about it correctly, almost everything you do becomes just that, an act of charity, an act of kindness, an act of supporting others. It's a wonderful thing. In fact, it's very one of the beautiful things about the Buddhist community as a whole is the interaction between the monastics and the lay community. Yeah, whereby lay, it's a very beautiful thing as a monastic to see all the people coming to the monastery, right? And coming to support you and offer you food and offer you requisites. It's a wonderful, very beautiful, wonderful thing just to see that happen. And then in return, you try to give something in return through living in the right way, through having the right lifestyle, and also hopefully through some teachings at the same time. It was a wonderful interaction. And everybody is gaining something out of it, right? Nobody is really losing out. This is one of the ways I like to think about an act which is spiritual, whether by body, speech and mind. It is spiritual if it is a benefit both for yourself and for other people. That is a spiritual act. If it's good for you and good for others at the same time, it's good. A more worldly act is one which is good for one but perhaps bad for the other one, like selfishness and these kind of things. Generosity is always good for everyone, good for the recipient and good for the person who gives, right? This is why how you know that it is something positive. So generosity, very important part of this path. Please keep that in mind, and it is kind of a little bit hidden here, but it is also part of the opposite of not giving. And again, remember here that the idea of stealing, or the idea, just like with killing, it comes in all kinds of shade of grey. Stealing is not the same thing. It depends enormously what you do. If you steal, for example, because things are very, very difficult in your life, or you need to support somebody who is almost dying or starving or something like that, perhaps you have the thought of giving it back after you have finished. That is a very different kind of thing from stealing just because you happen to be incredibly greedy or something like that. So again, it really depends on your mind state. Your mind state is what really imbues the act with morality or immorality. That is what really matters here. And all of this is very useful because it makes things much less black and white than what we normally think about these things. Okay, the last one, abandoning in celibacy. He observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. And this translation is not ideal, in my opinion. In celibacy here is abrahmacharya. It doesn't really mean celibate. What it means abstinence from any kind of sexual activity. That is what it really means. So abandoning sexual activity is really the appropriate translation there. That is the first part which isn't quite good about this translation. The other part which is not so good is this word of vulgar that has crept in there. And it kind of makes things, it is not nice because it kind of demeans something which is just an ordinary pleasure that most people partake of. And there's no need to kind of demean it unnecessarily. Buddhism doesn't really work like that. And the Pali word here is gamma, and gamma means pertaining to, belonging to the village. So in other words, belonging to or pertaining to ordinary people. That's what it really means. So it means the ordinary or the common practice of sexual intercourse. That is really what it means. And I think that is an important thing. It means that it is common. It is not elevated. It is not the kind of thing that you expect in, you know, with somebody who lives a very pure and very high life and deep meditation and that kind of thing, but that is really all it refers to. So again, we're talking here about the monastic life, of course, and for lay people, the main thing there is, of course, sexual misconduct, which is the main issue there. So again, the opposite here of this, the opposite of living, abstaining from sexuality, the opposite of that is precisely the happiness of the mind, right? The mental happiness, the mental aspect, which is a complete reverse of sensuality. Sensuality is much broader than just sexuality, but sexuality, of course, is kind of the main aspect of this, and this is why it is kind of brought out in this particular way. But the opposite is the mental happiness that you get through cultivating the spiritual path. Happiness that comes from morality, from generosity, and ultimately the happiness that comes from meditation itself. So why is it that these things are opposites? You know, very often you hear people say, oh, I want both parts. I want to both enjoy myself in the worldly way, and I also want the meditation. I don't want to give up one to have the other. I want to have both. Why can't we have both? I'm going to have both, and I'm going to do both things. That's what people often say. But is that really possible? And it is possible to some degree, of course. It is possible to use meditation to enhance your mindfulness and enhance your quality of your life. Regardless of how you live, to some extent you can do that. But the point is, there comes a point, there comes somewhere on this path where you have to make some degree of choice. And you have to reduce the sensual pleasures in your life to some extent, because otherwise you won't be able to access the pleasures of the mind in quite the same way. And this is why the monastic life is laid down in this way. That is why you live a celibate life, because by living this life of abstaining from sexuality, you're kind of, in a sense, you are forcing yourself to look for happiness in a different place. You're kind of aiding that process of giving up, of abandoning that kind of pleasure and to move in a different direction. You are almost forced to look for happiness somewhere else. Why is it that these things are opposed? And the reason is because the worldly pleasures that you get through the five senses, they are always external. It's about going out into the world, right? You see things, you hear nice things, you touch nice things, and it's always about something outside of yourself. Now, if you gain a lot of pleasure and happiness through those external things, it means that you have an attachment in that world. It is impossible to enjoy things in the world without having any kind of attachment to it. And because you are attached to it, if you try to give it up, you can't. Right? That's what attachment means. Attachment means precisely the fact that you're unable to give it up. Or it takes time for you. It is a gradual process of giving up before you can give these things up properly. So then when you try to meditate, you can't go any deeper. Why can't I'm sitting here, I'm meditating, I'm feeling kind of happy, but nothing really happens, I'm not going anywhere. Why? And one of the main reasons is because you still have attachments to those things in the world. The mind is holding on to that. The mind doesn't want to let go, because the mind is expecting happiness in that world. And that's why you can't go any deeper. So this is shows you that there is, at some point, there is a problem that the attachment to external things will stop you from going deeper into meditation. And this is why the giving up of the sensual desire is such an important part of the five hindrances. That is why it is there, because it blocks you from deepening your meditation practice. So this is how that is. So as you, on a retreat like this, as you give up a lot of the ordinary pleasures of the world, it also tends to give you more access to the pleasures of the mind. Because you're giving it up a little bit, your attachment is decreasing a little bit, it gives you more access to the mental pleasures. These things have some degree of opposition to them. You cannot have both fully. You can have more of one and less of another one, or more of the other, less of one, or completely one and nothing of the other. But you can't have both fully. That's impossible. You have to have some degree of choice between these things. But remember, it is a gradual thing. It is not something that you can force onto yourself. It is not about kind of chucking out your... chucking out all the nice things in your life when you come back home and then thinking that meditation is going to take off. It is not. It's probably going to get worse because you really suffer as a consequence. So do things gradually. Feel out. Try to understand the process. And as you do things gradually, and it comes natural, it will also work very nicely. It will be minimal suffering, and it will be a smooth and easy movement forward on the Buddhist path. Reflect on these things, see how things work in your life, and over time, gradually, your mind will move in the right direction. I will talk a little bit more about sensual pleasures and sensual objects later on this retreat. Some of my favorite suttas that I read out on every single retreat. I'm also going to talk about this on this retreat. It's somewhere in here. Yes, there it is. Okay, so we'll come later on then, and we'll talk more about this. But that gives you some idea of why it is that we practice in this way on the Buddhist path. Otherwise, it may sound kind of strange, and some people do find the idea of living the way of monastics really weird. But actually, it's not weird at all. It is a very positive experience, especially when you start to get access to meditation. It is a very positive positive thing, and that is really what it's all about. Anyway, so that is right action for you on the Buddhist path. Three factors usually. If there's anything, any bodily action which hasn't been mentioned, then it still comes under bodily action. It's just that this is just the three kind of main categories, but there may also be other things that also comes under this. So now let us have a quick look at right speech. This is Samma Vacha on the Buddhist path, and it is explained as follows. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks the truth, adheres to the truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. So here we have again this kind of twofold aspect of right speech. You don't lie, you don't speak false speech, but not only do you not lie, but you are deliberately trustworthy and reliable. You don't deceive people. You try to kind of be straight up and honest about what is going on. And this is an important thing, because often people think that, you know, there are some very clear lines here that you don't lie, end of story. And if you kind of very often people become a bit lawyer like when it comes to the precepts, and they want clear boundaries, right? Okay, this is lying. If I just step 1 millimeter outside of these kind of barriers or this kind of box of lying, then I'll be fine, right? So I want to know exactly the kind of the limits, so I'm kind of within the precepts. I don't really want to tell the truth, but I want to be within the precepts. How can I get away with things? That's often kind of the idea here. You become like a lawyer. But this doesn't work like law. Kamma is not law. Right? And this is also one of the interesting things about the precepts about the monastic vinaya. The monastic vinaya is also about this very, it's a legal structure really, and it creates kind of very clear limits, boundaries to what is acceptable and what is not. But reality of morality is much more flexible. Yeah, it is. You can lie outright, or you can kind of deceive a little bit, or deceive slightly. And there's all this kind of spectrum of what for wrong speech here. So the idea is to minimize that whole thing and to be as trustworthy as possible. That is the point, right? The point is not to kind of find the legal boundaries, but to maximize the right speech means to be as trustworthy as you possibly can. Not to kind of, be somebody who deceives things. Why do we deceive people? And very often it's because we feel embarrassed about something. You don't want to be honest about what you have done. You've done something you feel a bit embarrassed about, right? And you don't want to say. And very often it is better to be upfront about things and get over that. Okay, you're going to be embarrassed for a short while, but then you will be done with it. Instead of kind of dragging things out and making them worse in the long run. So this is the kind of thing that we are talking about here. So you are as trustworthy as you possibly can. This doesn't mean that we are blunt, right? And that we say things that are hurtful just because they are true. That is also the wrong idea. So if something happens to be true, but it's hurtful to others, of course, we have to take that into account. If you don't take that into account, you might do something which is unethical because you're hurting others through your speech. Yeah, so if you have a dilemma between hurting somebody and telling the truth, then you find out, well, maybe some other time I can talk about this. Maybe tell them this is not the right time to talk about this. Or maybe turn the conversation aside for now, or something like that. And then you act ethically also in that kind of context. So it is complicated, right? And it comes back to your intention. What is your intention? What are you trying to do? Are you trying to be kind, compassionate, and wise? And then you know you are on the right track. If you are confused, just grasp onto the five precepts. Okay, you can't go very far wrong if you hold on to the five precepts. So this is what it is about. And remember that the idea of lying, again, comes in a vast number of categories and shades of grey, from the most outright lying. You go to court, right? And the court says, we kind of put your hand on the Dhammapada and says, I promise to tell the full truth, right? We don't use the Bible as Buddhists, we use the Dhammapada. That I promise to tell the full truth. In the name of the Lord Buddha, I promise to tell everything it's true. And not kind of leave anything out. And then you lie through your teeth afterwards, right? Oh, that is the really bad kind of lying. And sometimes when you look at while you lie, the reason is often just very bad reasons. You want to protect yourself a little bit or protect somebody else. And actually you just make things far worse by doing that. So that is the bad kind of lying. And then other kinds of lying. And this is the story that Ajahn Brahm always tells, the story of a man who was in hospital, was waiting for some kind of bypass surgery, and he was in a room with somebody else, another man who also was waiting for bypass surgery. And then one day his friend gets wheeled into the operating theater, and then he doesn't come back again, right? So he gets a bit concerned. What happened to my friend? He was going to have bypass surgery. I'm waiting for the same procedure. He's getting a bit worried about what's going on. And his wife comes to visit him, and he asks his wife, what happened to my friend? And his wife happens to know that his friend died during the operation. There is a small percentage, I think something like 3% or something, who died during bypass surgery. And he was one of those unlucky ones. And then the wife knows that if she tells her husband that his friend died, he'd probably get very anxious, right? Very worried. It's quite natural. Maybe, the doctor here isn't so good or something like that. And so she tells him, don't worry, he's all right or whatever, something like that. Basically, she was lying. But in that kind of situation, it's very, very different. Because in that situation, she just didn't know what to say. It's very, very hard to say the right thing in that kind of situation. So she lied. But of course, it is a very, very different kind of thing from the situation I was talking about before. So again, it shows you that it is not black and white. It's shades of grey. Why are we doing things? If you are about to lie, red light, be careful. Am I doing the right thing or not? So you are much more careful in that situation. But if you feel that in this case it is required, then in certain situations it, I think, is perfectly acceptable. So that is, again, the idea of false speech, of being trustworthy and reliable. No deceiver of the world, right? It's a very, very nice way of looking at things. And then we have the second factor of wrong speech, or right speech rather, abandoning malicious speech. He abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, who enjoys concord, samagi, it's like harmony, right? Unity, coming together, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. So we try to bring people together rather than divide people. Sometimes if you don't like somebody, you're having a problem with somebody, it's so easy to say negative things about them, right? It's so easy to kind of complain, oh, I'm having such a hard time, this person is giving me a hard time or whatever. But very often, if we do that, if we talk negatively about somebody else, we create divisions. Yeah, this is the nature of saying something negative, because the other person also then gets a negative perception of the person you are talking about. So instead of doing that, we just try to understand instead. We try to see that people have their difficulties, people are people do things that are silly here, and we come from a sense of compassion and understanding rather than a sense of judgment. And when we do that, we can actually bring people together here. And it's a very, very beautiful thing, right, to be able to bring people together here. And we need this in this world. We don't need any more division. We don't need to kind of decry people as bad. Even when people are terrorists and do bad things, we realize that they are doing these things for a reason, because they have been conditioned in a bad way. We don't we don't say kill the terrorist and become terrorists ourselves. That doesn't really help the situation at all. We're just kind of keeping it rolling, keeping it, making it worse. Instead, we try to understand, we try to unite, try to bring people together, try to solve the root causes of the problem rather than kind of patching it up with a few band-aids. It's never really going to go anywhere. And then we're heading in the right way. So this idea is, again, very, very, very beautiful and very, very wholesome. And it kind of makes us unified as humanity, instead of being so tribal, always dividing up us against them, this nation against that nation, this tribe against that tribe, this, whatever it is. And it's really silly, because we have far, far more in common as human beings than what we have that divides us. The things that divide us are just the superficial little things. The things we have in common are the things that really matter. If you look at us, we have basically the same aspirations in life. We all want to be happy. We all want to be content. We all want to avoid unnecessary suffering and problems. We're all in the same boat, really. So because of that, we should be able to care for each other, regardless of background, regardless of culture, nationality, gender, wealth or lack of wealth, education, intelligence, all of these kind of things, age, all of that, forget about it. That's kind of irrelevant. And then you can bring some unity to humanity, if you think in that sense. Also religion, by the way. I should bring Tetsuya religion as well, because that's one of the great dividers in the world. Okay. Abandoning harsh speech. He abstains from harsh speech. He speaks words, such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, agreeable to many. Yeah, so that is almost self-explanatory. But again, one of those very beautiful little sentences, right, that you see in the suttas, one of those so memorable, the words that are pleasing to the ear, lovable, go to the heart, hadaya gamma, literally means, in Pali, exactly as in English, literally means go to the heart. That's exactly what it means. The kind of word that you love to hear when you're around people who speak like that, you feel happy because they kind of speak in the right way, and you feel good about that. Now, I should say perhaps at this point that one of the things here is that, of course, we're talking about three kinds of bodily action, four kinds of speech, and there is a particular sequence here, right? This sequence is always exactly the same. And as always, in the suttas, sequence is important. Sequence matters. So what we are seeing here, we're seeing the most important type of right speech is to tell the truth. That is the most important one. The second one is the one to unite people, bring people together. The third one is to speak speech that is gentle and not harsh. And the last one is the idle chatter coming at the end. Exactly the same thing with the actions, right? The most important thing is not to kill living beings. Then comes stealing. Then comes the idea of living with sexual abstinence. So these are graded. Everything in Buddhism is like that. Everything is graded. Everything has a specific sequence. Remember at the beginning yesterday, we're talking about the word of the Buddha being sa-attang, sa-vyanjanang. Yeah? Sa-attang, having a real purpose, a goal, but also having the right phrasing. Yeah, it is phrased in a certain way. Everything is done on purpose. So that is an important thing to take into account here as well. So if you have any doubts about where you should begin, you should always begin at the top of the list and then work yourself down there. So here we have the idea of abandoning harsh speech and going towards gentle speech, not kind of swearing harshly to other people, using kind of a harsh tone of voice. A lot of what we say, it actually comes out in the tone in which we say it, right? This is one of those important things there. And the last one, abandoning, it says gossip here. Sampapalapa is the Pali word. It means something like idle chatter. And he abstains from idle chatter. Speaks at the right time. Speaks what is fact. Speaks on what is good. Speaks on the teaching. The Dhamma is the teaching. And the Vinaya. Vinaya here is the word. Vinaya means like training. I don't think discipline is quite right here. Speaks on the teaching and the training. And the training, of course, is precisely this that we're reading out now. At the right time, he speaks such words that are worth recording, that are reasonable, that are moderate and beneficial. Worth recording, Nidana Vatti in Pali. They are treasurable, is quite literally what it means, to be treasured. Reasonable, sappadana, I think. It means that they come with a, they are reasonable. They're not kind of random words. They're kind of, they're backed up by reasons and they kind of make sense. Moderate means you don't talk too much. You don't keep on going forever, but you know the limits of your speech. And beneficial. So at the right time. This idea of right time is also a very important part of the Buddhist idea of doing right things, especially right speech. There is a time to say things and there is a time not to say things. Often the problem is that we tend to speak when we want to speak, rather than asking ourselves whether it is appropriate. Very often defilements compel us to do things. The defilements say, now, you've got to tell them off, you've got to teach them a lesson, you've got to say something, or you just want to talk because your mind is running riot, and you're restless or whatever. But is it the right time? That is really the question that we sometimes need to ask. Is the other person open to listen? Do they want to listen to what we have to say? All of these kind of things also come into this. So right time is an important part of right speech on the Buddhist path. So there you are. These are the right action and right speech. And I think the again, it is very, I find it very fascinating, this whole idea of morality on the Buddhist path, precisely because it is so flexible and so profound and based on such natural principle. It's very easy to see why this is why this kind of morality really works. It's about whether you are hurting somebody or not, and whether you're hurting somebody or not, basically it comes back to your intentions. What is your intention? What is your motivation? Sometimes we get it wrong, right? We have the motivation to be kind, and somehow we have misunderstood the situation, and that is okay, because you can never get everything absolutely right. As long as we get it right most of the time, then the right motivation is going to be what decides the morality of our acts. So, there you are. I'm going to stop there. That's pretty much exactly at the right time. So, and then later on today we can move on a little bit more, and we're going to start coming into right effort very soon. And that in many ways is, to me, one of the most interesting parts of the Buddhist path. That is where we change our mental outlook and all of that. So I'll see you again at 3 o'clock. In the meantime, please keep on enjoying yourself.